You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Steve Magnus, who's been on the podcast a couple times before. Steve is a world-renowned expert on performance, well-being, and sustainable success. In his coaching practice, Steve works with executives, entrepreneurs, and athletes on their performance and mental skills. He served as a consultant on mental skills development for professional sports teams, including some of the top teams in professional sports. He has written several books, and his latest is called Win the Inside Game: How to Move from Surviving to Thriving and Free Yourself Up to Perform. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock.
Steve Magnus, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So you had this dream job at Nike where you were a coach for the world's premier professional running team, which was the Nike Oregon Project. And then your boss asked you to do something. What was that?
He asked me to essentially get a large amount of a substance called L-carnitine mixed with a saline solution injected into my body.
That doesn't seem right or okay.
It doesn't.
No.
And it turns out it wasn't. It wasn't legal to do it in that manner. But I think when, you know, the context here is this, is I was, I think, 25 or 26. It was my first, I'd say, real actual job, you know, besides the stuff we all have before that, out of grad school, where I said, okay, I made it big. I'm at Nike, the premier running brand in the world, and I'm coaching people who are going to go on to literally become Olympic champions, and I'm helping them out. Yeah. Assistant coach, scientific advisor, working with a legend in the sport. And what happens in these situations is you go in thinking like, okay, like I know my morals, my values, I know what I'm going to do. And then things get pressed a little bit and you start questioning things where you're like, oh no, like we'll justify this. We'll be okay here. And then long story short, what happens is I'm literally sitting in a doctor's office in Houston, Texas, having a substance injected into my body, which is something that I could never have imagined even months before.
And you ended up blowing the whistle on these guys.
I did. So the long story short is I spent, essentially it took 10 years of my life where I hit a point where first I quit and I wanted nothing to do with it. I just wanted out. I said, no, this is crazy. I don't want anything to do with it. But it just kept gnawing at me where eventually I said, you know what? There were some lines crossed. There's more than just injecting of supplements. There's some things that I saw. And I tried to put it out of my head, but I couldn't. And eventually I, you know, wrote an email and then spent 10 years of my life talking to U.S. Anti-Doping, which was the governing body for sport that handled these things.
And this, I mean, for those, you know, don't remember this or whatever, this was a big deal. I mean, people went to prison. It was bad. And the thing is, like, doing the ethical thing is almost always the harder thing. And you have a really interesting thing you say early on in the book. You say, quote, "The Steve who stayed silent and went along and the Steve who spoke up are the same people, but they are also fundamentally different, end quote. Talk about that. How, you know, because it is, it's like, yeah, you are this and you are also that, which is kind of the way we are as people. And I think it's fundamental to the everything you talk about in this book.
Yeah. So what it is dealing with the messiness. I think we like our stories simple. You know, I have a toddler daughter who just started watching, you know, some Disney princess movies or reading the Disney princess books. And they're all simple. It's like good versus evil, like right versus wrong. And I think to some degree, and the literature and research backs this up, we carry around that story in our head as adults. We think, I would do the right thing because I'm a good person. I'm on this side. No one or very few people think they're on the wrong side of anything. But what I try and get across from this is that if we live in fantasy land where it's good or evil, then we don't ever deal with the actual nuance and substance of real life. We don't wrestle with the fact that I was the same person who had a liter of substance injected into my body as the same person who blew the whistle and led to people getting banned from sport and the betterment of sport. And overall, I think a very good thing is those people are the same. And in order to deal with that, you have to say, okay, that messiness is something that is fundamental of all of us. But if we ignore it and we avoid it, I don't think we ever get to the point where we can display our courage because we're stuck in like protecting this fantasy of good versus evil.
It's interesting. I have a podcast later this week with Shannon Watts, who started Moms Demand Action, the fighting gun violence. And her new book starts with this midlife crisis, terrible divorce, all the things that led her to do what she did. And as I was sort of forming my first question for her, I think it's very similar to what you talk about here, which is, and it surprises me that we do have a rich history of literature, art, film, philosophy that show us that greatness comes out of great struggle. And you know, everything from Kierkegaard's existential leap of faith to Kerouac's Beat Generation being a beaten down, all these stories are all around us. And yet, we don't seem to have learned the lesson because we expect everything to be easier than it is.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of humans are storytelling machines. It's what made us great and different from everybody else. But I think what happens is this, is when we feel anxious, stressed, overwhelmed, you know, maybe not like we belong in places, what happens is our stories get simpler and simpler. Is stress narrows us. And what happens is we cease to see that like the struggle is often where the meaning is found. The discomfort is often the thing that leads to perspective. But when you're in the thick of it, when you're in the midst of it, like your brain essentially simplifies. And we have data and research on this. Like in, you look at, again, in sport or, you know, other performances, literally as stress increases, our prefrontal cortex gets shut down, which our prefrontal cortex is essentially our kind of like thinking, mental sketch pad part of our brain. And that gets shut down in our amygdala, which is more kind of like emotion, threat detection, like, you know, quick fight or flight response. That takes over. So if you zoom out and you say, okay, if most of us nowadays are kind of somewhat stressed, if we live in a world where we feel like, hey, I've got a lot of social media followers and friends, but real life connections might not be there, then I think it's, of course, we ignore all the deep literature and the deep understanding, you know, from those you mentioned to Viktor Frankl, who all say like struggle, meaning like this is where the depth is. And we say, no. I want to like protect, to keep things simple, to avoid any sort of challenge. And that includes challenge to myself as like this simple, good person instead of dealing with the messiness.
So downstairs, the Second City is the first today is the first day of general auditions, which we do every year. And you can imagine, right? We're seeing about 500 people, you know, for three slots, whatever it is.
And I was explaining, we have a new CFO, and he was asking about auditions. He's like, that must be fun. And I'm like, it's not fun. So, and the reason it's not fun, as I say, I did this for so many decades here. I don't have to anymore. But what would happen is you would see, there's usually like, let's say 8 people, and they walk on stage. I could note who was going to bomb just based on how much they're shaking, literally, or sweating, or whatever. Like, so they get the yips. And that happens here. And many of these people back when I was first doing this were people I knew were good. Like, yeah. I had seen them. And so I started actually discounting auditions a lot and just going places and seeing people. But, like, what does that have to do with, like, Rick Ankiel suddenly can't pitch? It's kind of the same thing, right?
Oh, it's absolutely the same thing. I mean, this is in sport, we call it the yips, right? Or gymnastics, the twisties. We know it when we see it. We see a baseball player, like Rick Ankiel, spent his whole life learning to throw a baseball, literally a world expert at it. And then all of a sudden, like, he can't do what a middle schooler could do, which is like toss a baseball somewhat accurately, to the other player. And it's crazy. But what happens and why it's similar to the same thing you see in auditions is essentially our brain is going, hold on here. Like, this stress, this pressure is overwhelming. I'm just going to shut you down, right? It's no different than probably our ancient ancestor out on the savannah who, like, comes across some overwhelming stress by themselves, maybe a bear, lion, tiger, and like literally freezes or sometimes faints. Why? Because our brain goes, oh crap, this is overwhelming. Like, I don't have the capabilities to like take this challenge on. Just shut down, escape, get out of here, do whatever you can. And it's the same that you see in performing arts. It's your own version of the yips.
Is the opposite flow?
So that's a good question. To a degree, yes. So I'm going to give you a little nuance here. Good. Is the opposite flow occurs when we have an ideal balance between challenge and, you know, what we're capable of. So we have that audition, but we've practiced a lot, mm-hmm. and we've maybe been in other auditions before, so we know what to expect. And we can say, hey, this is going to be really hard, but I've got just enough capabilities to take it on, okay? And what generally happens is we have optimal stress instead of overwhelmed. It's stress that is seen as a challenge instead of a threat, and we experience flow. But there's one other indicator or one other state where we can also perform well that isn't flow, that when the demands exceed a little bit more our capabilities, and researchers call it a clutch state. And basically, it's like this. It's saying, hey, this audition is going to be really hard, but I need it. Maybe it's to pay the bills or like, this is my last chance. Or in sporting context, you know, I'm the quarterback and I have one drive. And if we don't score on this, we lose the game. And what research shows is that in clutch states is unlike flow, where it kind of feels effortless, like you're just in the zone, right?
Yeah.
Clutch, you're literally fighting for every second or yard or joke or whatever it is. Like, you are fighting for it, but it's just on the right side of I can fight for it and I'm not overwhelmed by it. So it's really interesting because I kind of see these three states working together a little bit where the yips, the overwhelm is just like checkout, right? Yeah. Flow is like, I can get this. It's hard, but I'm in the zone. And then clutch is like, this kind of sucks, but I'm going to make it happen instead of force it. And by making it happen, I'm still going to perform at a high level, even if it's not as pleasant as flow, if that makes sense.
So I know this isn't necessarily linear, but can you achieve clutch if you haven't experienced flow? It strikes me that flow is necessary element to get you. I'm just thinking Michael Jordan, who had both.
It's a great example. I think Jordan is the perfect example. And I think you need to, yeah, I think although there's no research behind this, I would say that yeah. You know, in my gut feeling, sure.
All All right. So part of what I love about this book is it's so wide in its scope. It's not just about sports. It's not just about science. It's also cultural. And you write, quote, in 1931, historian James Truslow Adams coined the term American Dream. But he did so not to give the U.S. a pat on the back, but to show how we'd gone astray. Adams warned that the original noble ideal had transformed from focusing on well-being, moral character, and opportunity to a dream of material plenty, end quote. I had no idea.
You know, that's I'm not a historian, but I love history, so I love going down these rabbit holes. And I think what's interesting, again, if you go down some of these rabbit holes on, for instance, what Adam said, or if we go back further to the founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, who I talk about in the book, is often the original idea of these things where we think, oh, American dream, like that means just like endless pursuit of whatever. Whatever our pursuit is, endless, it doesn't jive with the original intent. The original intent on Adams was, again, a reaction to the Gilded Age, where he said, hold up. This used to be about personal development, well-being, like being better so that we can, you know, do well for society, not just getting things. Or if we go back to Adam Smith, who's, again, founder of capitalism, people think greed is good when they think capitalism. But what Smith literally writes about is he said, hey, again, paraphrasing here, but he says, hey, if you go down this path of like endless consumption, you are going to be miserable. He says you have to essentially balance it out where I think he called it tranquility and contentment. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that other side of the equation, like you're not going to A, perform well or live well. And I think what we often do is we forget that side. We say, oh no, if you want to be the best at anything, like we've got to go pursue it recklessly and for the, you know, the external accolades that come with it.
There's another aspect to this early on that sort of sets the stage. And you write, quote, for much of history, failure or just about anything bad that occurred was attributed to something else, end quote. And that's like God's will or that sort of thing. And you actually say that changed in modern times and that Scott Sandage traces that history to the rise of bank credit ratings.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I checked this out too, is if you look at the phrase used when something bad happened, it used to be, or now it's, I am a failure, right? Mm-hmm. If we lose a race, if we don't get our audition, like we say, I'm a failure. That phrase didn't exist that much. It was very rare before, you know, basically the 19th century. And Sandage traced it to bank credit ratings, which essentially was at some point banks needed to, you know, rate you for, are you good for paying this loan back? And again, this is an era pre-connection to anything, let alone internet or phone or what have you. So they needed to rate you. So what happened is those who weren't good for, you know, a loan, they became labeled good for nothing. That's where that phrase came from. And what we see here is this intertwining of essentially job and success and failure, where before it was kind of separate. It was, I didn't do well at this job, or my crops failed because of, you know, the weather didn't cooperate, not because I wasn't a good enough farmer. But this intertwining changed that. And what happens is now, we take our failures and successes as being representative of our personal self-worth and self-efficacy, which can backfire if that's our only source of those things.
Well, this is so present in what we teach, because the beginning improv classes are all about letting people experience failure over and over and over again and recognizing it didn't kill them. And so that they create a space to play. So when I'm talking to companies, and I do this probably every other week at some interactive keynote, I'm always talking about this difference between creativity and innovation, and that you can have creativity with zero innovation. It happens all the time. But you actually can't have innovation without creativity, and creativity is messy. So you have to create space for mess and exploration. And then I have to quickly also say to these audiences, and that doesn't mean that there's not the space for no, which I think is the narrow space that you talk about. You have to eventually get to something. You probably need time limits on that too, but that also means you have to have time for pure exploration.
Absolutely. And as adults, we tend to suck at it.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to bring it back. I've got a toddler. If you look around, what is she a pro at? Exploration. Because mm-hmm. all it is figuring out her world. And if she fails, she gets up because she doesn't understand that failure is quote unquote bad. It's just like I stumbled, brushed myself off, go explore something else or explore it again. And I think as adults, what happens is we get these protective mechanisms that tell us like avoid failure because it represents you. And when we live in that space, we stop playing. As you said, we stop exploring. And there's all sorts of research that shows this from whether we're talking, you know, performances like yours, or if we're talking sciences, we're talking athletes, is we tend to narrow as we grow older. But what we often need is to go back to that exploration mode, not just for creativity, but also because exploration is at the heart of developing intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where, you know, play is, by definition, intrinsic motivation. It's what we did as kids. And if we lose that and we don't keep stoking that fire, then what ends up happening is our motivation shifts over the long haul to be more about those external things, which, guess what? If it's too much about the external, then every audition becomes that life or death moment, or every improv situation becomes like, did I nail this or am I a complete disaster? And no one performs well in that situation.
And no one hits 1,000. Yep. Like, no one hits 1,000. And like, what, maybe one or two people hit 400?
Yeah.
It's like Ted Williams and like that's it. So, all right. So let's use that analogy. So if the greatest of all time failed 60% of the time, this applies to all of us in everything we do. And that's also the thing that I think people don't understand. It's like they might get it in the context of, yeah, going for that big game or whatever. There's a game every day. Every moment we live, this is happening in terms of the way we communicate. And so the ability to self-regulate in a moment, to understand that you probably don't understand everything that's going on, because how could you, you know, gives you a fighting chance to maybe be right 40% of the time, if you're the best. So for the rest of it, what, it's like 20%, maybe 30%? I think there's a research around that Nick Epley has done and others. So this is just... Okay, I want to ask you this question. Sorry, I went on a die trip. Only 50% of cookbook authors go on to produce a follow-up. A, where did you find that? And B, why?
Yeah, so there's some fascinating research. I forget the author by the name, but I stumbled upon it where he was looking at essentially, you know, hot streaks and choking and in mm-hmm. our identity. And what they found is that cookbook study is that when cookbook authors were successful in their first go round, and more so if they had like received some sort of award for their book for like creativity or innovation or what have you, is they more often than not did not produce a follow up. And when the researchers looked into it, they found that it was because their identity had essentially intertwined with, I am a cookbook author, a creative cookbook author, and if I cannot come up with the second go round that matches this, then I'm better off not trying. And this is why they don't try. And you can see this in other, you know, performance atmospheres. So like the one hit wonder phenomenon in, you know, music. If you look at it, generally artists, you know, musicians will produce another album. But again, what the research shows is they tend to get stuck by their first album mm-hmm. instead of keeping that exploration process going. And they're stuck because they're like, oh my gosh, I'm now known as, you know, the singer songwriter of X song. I've got to like exactly replicate it. And we get stuck in this fear of failure state.
Yeah, I you know, you see that, of course, in the arts all the time. And I think I feel so lucky because I, you know, I got into theater because I wanted to be a playwright, didn't end up becoming a playwright, and didn't even really know Second City did improvisation, to be honest with you, when I first got my dishwashing gig here. But I'm just so blessed that I did come here because we create original reviews every year. We only do original. And yes, we have a process that's kind of the same, and we're creating a product that generally kind of looks the same. It's different at different periods, but it's sketches and improv and music and those sorts of things. But it's always original. So, and we get good reviews and we get not so good reviews. And it's like, but we don't live and die by them. Most theaters don't do that. Most, a commercial theater certainly would never survive doing a bunch of first-time plays. You know, that's why Phantom exists, because people need to sell tickets. But, like, doing Phantom over and over and over again doesn't feel especially it's probably not the reason these people signed up to get into the field. And, you know, and I know when I speak at these conferences, I always say the biggest enemy of innovation is past success. And I'm curious if that – do you think that that was true for you at a certain point? Because I know you had some success as an athlete.
Absolutely, I do. I mean, I think what happens is we get really good at something. And in fact, the research shows this, is we start to cement around that thing. Because for myself, I had really good success. I was a high school phenom running a 4-minute mile as a high schooler. And your identity literally cements around, this is who I am. This is what I'm good at. I'm going to keep doing this thing over and over and over again. And getting back to what we talked about earlier, it makes it where you stop exploring. Now, we could talk about this from an identity standpoint, or we could talk about this from a performance standpoint in other things. Like, for instance, you can look at the success of movies compared to now, compared to 30 years ago. If we look at 30 years ago, almost everyone was original. Mm-hmm. If we look now at the box office lists, like besides, I don't know, Sinners, like everything else is like number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the series. And the reason for that is because, again, success cements us. Whether it's individually or group, we think, okay, this did well. So it's safer to do this thing over and over and over again and just shift a little bit. It essentially pushes us to, instead of like playing to win, we kind of play not to lose. It's the safer bet. But when you always live in that space, and I'm not saying that like we don't need sequels and we don't need, you know, to see Phantom of the Opera, you know, a bunch of times. Like, we need space for that. But if everyone lives in that space, it gets rid of that creativity and that innovation, both for us as individuals and then also as a group. And again, tying it back to the identity research, we can see this clearly as if you were really good at something early, like you're a phenom or a prodigy, you tend to struggle more as you get into your mid or later adulthood, because your identity cemented around one thing so much that, unlike your, you know, friends in high school where you were exploring all this stuff and you realize, hey, I have a lot of interests, you didn't get that opportunity. And now you're kind of a little bit more fragile of a self and don't have this resilience because you are good or interesting at all these other things. So if, you know, acting doesn't work out in this domain, you can go pursue it in a different domain or a different thing and be okay with it.
I can't believe I actually didn't write this down earlier and it didn't come to me, but I think there's a reason. So I don't know if we talked about this, but I was a phenom soccer player. In grade school, I worked out with the high school team. I went to state as a starting center forward my junior year of high school. We lost to Grant City. I never touched a soccer ball after. I quit the team. I had people offering scholarships, didn't take them to college. Parents were not happy about that. And I just, I didn't, I knew at that point I wanted to be someone different. And now I'm looking at like, oh, A, why did I not remember that when I was reading this book and telling these stories? But I changed my story.
Yep.
I did the thing you talk about. And it was like, no, I'm going to be someone different. And it's worked out great. You know, like, and I was never, especially at that time in the 80s, it's not like today where I maybe could have gone to England to make some money, you know, or Germany or whatever. There was nothing. Like, I would be a bench player for the Tampa Bay Rowdies and it would be like not good. Screw up my knees. But this is you actually say learning to lose well means changing your story. I think that's an element of what happened for me that I think is really important. And I don't know that it's easy. I feel like I had a lot of, support and privilege to let me do that, but for a lot of people, they don't have it.
Yeah, and that's part of the. I think that's a wonderful story and a great example, and kudos for making that switch. That's really hard. But I think you're right. I think the way I kind of look at it is like some of us have the privilege and ability to make that switch easier because we have the security to do so. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, and there's research on this. This is why. Those in extreme poverty or grew up in poverty often struggle with this because for, you know, myself and I'm guessing you, like we've got parents who like might be a little upset that we didn't take the college scholarship, but like we still have that support system behind us that gives us that security to take that new risk. When you've grown up in a situation where you don't have that, what happens is, and again, there's research on this, we have almost like a hyper-reactive alarm that goes like, oh no, if I don't succeed at this, like I have nothing else. Like I can't pivot. I can't change. I have to grasp onto this one story because this is the only thing I have to grasp onto. And I think sometimes as a society, we don't do a good job providing support and, almost that safety net to allow people to explore and figure out how to get where they need to be.
So for sure, I had great relationships and I have throughout my life and they have saved me time and time again. But also I grew up, there was no phones that you took with you. You know, there was no computers. And you write in the book, quote, part of the problem is we've killed the primary way we form bonds. Hanging out. We've replaced it with either the superficial or the overly scheduled. We don't meet up and then figure out what to do, end quote. That's completely what I did. It would be like, oh, you want to hang out? Great. I'll be over at this time. And then we figured it out. There's not a kid today who does that.
No. And it's bad. Like it's bad. I did the same thing. And again, this isn't just my opinion. Literally, when researchers look at how do we form bonds and connections from friends to adults in the office place to everywhere else, it is the in-between times. When the U.S. military studied how they form bonds within their groups or squadrons or what have you, which those guys form serious bonds, as they looked at it, it wasn't the training. It wasn't, you know, any of the regimented stuff. It was literally when they were, you know, in between, you know, sessions or whatever they had to do. And they're like, hey, we're in the middle of nowhere. We got to kill some time. Let's hang out and shoot the shit. When they look at the workplace, if you look at where bonds are created, it's literally the water cooler, the coffee shop, the midday, maybe lunch breaks. It's having paths for that in-between time. And the reason is simple is because you start to see someone for an actual like 3D, you know, person instead of like, hey, that's Joe the accountant. And like, I don't know anything about him except for the work that he does. They're two-dimensional. And I think especially with our kids, we've kind of gone the other way where it's like, oh, who are you on social media? You're this 2D caricature and I'm gonna like, you know, respond to that. And it's not how we form relationships and bonding. And the last thing I'll say on this, because I think it's so important, is if you look at the latest psychological theories, they essentially say we developed to co-regulate. Our nervous systems co-regulate. What does that mean? It means we didn't evolve to handle the stressors by ourselves.
Right.
We evolved to share the load. Mm-hmm. And if we can't share the load, like, we're going to be in a much worse place. And they've had all sorts of research that shows that, like, you know, one of my favorite studies is they took spouses and significant others and they stuck one in the fMRI machine to see what their brain was doing. And then they literally just shocked them. So a painful shock. And then they looked at, okay, what is the pain and fear centers doing in the brain? When it was them alone, through the roof, right? Fear, pain, feel it all. When literally they just change it and had their spouse or significant other sit there and hold their hand, not say anything, hold their hand, fear and pain centers go up about half as much. And the degree that, like, it helped was directly related to the strength of that person's relationship. So again, like, we co-regulate. And if we take that away, what kind of society do we think we're going to have? And how resilient do we think people are going to be when they don't have that connection and belonging?
Yeah, there's that other study too about, like, climbing a hill. And then when you're with someone else, you don't see it as steep. I mean, it's just like, it's over and over and over again. And yet we, you know, people aren't hanging out. They're lonely. They're not having sex. I mean, it's like all the warning signs are there. And I'm not a Jonathan Haidt type guy of, like, that these devices are purely evil. There's wonderful things in terms of for people who actually don't have that connection and can actually have some. But, you know, let's put it down on occasion. let's if we're in an improv workshop where you can't have a phone, you'll be okay for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And you're going to be fed. Your fire is going to be fed.
And I think, you know, one point on that, I'm with you 100%, is I think phones are part of our world. Like, we can't change that. But what we know is exactly what you said is, like, A, we suck at multitasking.
Yep.
So if your phone is, like, around or nearby or, like, sitting in front of you where you're, you know, eating dinner or whatever have you, guess what? You're not going to connect that well because half your brain is on your phone paying attention to that. And we know, again, part of connection isn't just what we say. It's our literal vision and brain taking in, like, the appearance of the other person, their gestures, their mannerisms, the eye contact, all that comes into play. So it's the same, I imagine, with, like, improv.
Yeah.
Is you have to be able to, your brain wants to read the other person. It wants to connect with the other person in that way. And if we have our phone right there, it's just not going to. So I think you're spot on, is we need the spaces to say, hey, you know what? For these 3 hours during improv practice, like, that phone stays in the locker or in the car or bag, whatever it is, away from you.
All right. I want you to tell the story of Cleet Keller, who was one of Michael Phelps's teammates in the Olympics.
Yeah, he's a multi-time Olympian, a Olympic medalist, one of the best swimmers in the world and that the U.S. had, and he had a lot of success. But from a young age, as we talked about earlier, his identity was cemented around swimming. So what happens? Once swimming ends, because for him, a couple of injuries that were devastating and some other things, is he kind of got lost. Because, there's research on this, and I've talked to a lot of athletes, and with athletes, they call it athletes die twice, which is, you know, one when we actually die, but one when your sport ends. Yeah. And unlike most professions, like, where we can do it for a really long time, when you're an athlete, your career ends often when you're, like, 30, when everyone else is coming into their prime. And then you look around and you're like, oh gosh, I've got to, especially in a sport like swimming, where you're not a multi-millionaire, you're like, I've got to find something else to do. And I'm a decade or more behind everybody else my age and have to start over. And it feels kind of humbling and can take you, you know, and hit you pretty hard. And for Keller, it hit him hard. And his kind of marriage dissolved a little bit, and he had struggles and all sorts of stuff. And it seemed like for a minute there, he was getting his life back on track. But then it turned out, if you watch the, you know, January 6th Capitol, whatever we want to call it, everybody going into it in craziness, is you would see there was a very large man with Olympic jacket, a U.S. Olympic jacket in the video. And that happened to be Keller. And what, if you, you know, look at what his teammates said, and I quoted one in the book, he put it brilliantly. He said, you know what? These groups attract people who are lost, and they give them a temporary sense of, oh, I've got this connection. I fit in here. I belong. But it's all a facade. It's superficial. And I think that's what we see, whether we're looking at things like, you know, the Capitol insurrection, or if we think of, you know, extreme groups online, is they kind of give us a superficial fitting in instead of filling that space or that void with like genuine connection and belonging.
Yeah, I have an old friend who was there too, who is someone who worked at Second City, had early success in their career, but had not had it for 15 years or so. And no one from the old days was actually talking to this person. And then we're like, oh my God, is that him? And it was. So just, all right. We end the podcast usually with a yes and story. You've given us that. Or thank you because story, you've given us that. I actually came up with my idea while we were doing this, which is what I should have asked you. And if you don't have one, that's fine, is a no story. And I think that's what the book is essentially. At a certain point, you said no to great cost. But had you not said that no, I think everything would have been much worse.
Absolutely. You're spot on. I mean, that's my story is. And I think if you look at it in the short term, and this is where I think, again, maybe putting it all in a bow, in the short term, not saying no probably would have been a little easier.
Sure.
Because I could have been like, okay, I'm just going to go along with this ride. I'll get some names and accolades on my resume. You know, make some money, all of that stuff. But over the long term, it would have been me miserable. I would have been lost. My sense of self would have been fractured. My, you know, meaning, purpose would have all just kind of disappeared. And I probably would have been jaded and just kind of miserable. And I think what happens is when we say no often is it is the short-term pain for the long-term gain. It's the thing that often opens up a path for what we talked about at the beginning, that growth, that understanding, that getting clarity on who you are and where you want to go. And if you have that, guess what? That's going to fuel you into whatever you take on next. And I think that too often we're a bit, you know, protective and self-limiting, and saying no is the thing that allows us to get through it.
I can't recommend this book enough. It's called Win the Inside Game, How to Move from Surviving to Thriving and Free Yourself Up to Perform. Steve Magnus, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming atop of their lungs.
survive.